I think it's a good thing that I'm finalizing, because I'm going to be talking about an application of a problem that is actually a missing data problem with missing covariates. And it has a little bit of everything. It has a little bit of double robustness. It has non-ignorability versus ignorability. It has the curse of dimensionality and so forth. It's a very simple problem, actually. It's a problem where we are interested in estimating the a parameter that pertains to the conditional distribution of an outcome given a binary covariate. And what's missing is the binary covariate. And we have very strong reasons to believe that missingness is not missing at random, even after we condition on all known covariates. So this is joint work with David Faraci at the University of Haifa and Enrique Schisterman at the National Institutes of Health. And, okay, so the problem, very briefly, the general problem is to assess the discriminatory ability of a new diagnostic test. We want to evaluate a new available test that doctors started using, and they started using for screening. And one parameter that generally is being used to assess the diagnostic ability, and I chose this parameter just for illustration purposes, because really there are many others that I could have used, is the area under the receiving operating characteristic curve. I'll explain that in a minute. And the problem, the big problem, is that not all patients go disease verification, essentially because to verify the disease, it involves, in the problem that I have, an invasive procedure. So doctors will never send the patient when they, unless they are really have very good suspicions that there is a reason to believe that the patient is ill. In fact, the problem that I want to talk, the motivating study, is a problem where we want to estimate or to evaluate the ability of electron beam computed tomography, which is a high-speed computed tomography that actually evaluates or measures the degree of calcification in the coronary arteries. And the question is, can we use this computed tomography to actually discriminate asymptomatic patients, patients that come to the clinic for checkup, regular checkups, and but they have risk factors. They have a family history of coronary heart disease, and they smoke, and they are old, and so forth. So we send them to take this cheap or relatively cheap, or at least not invasive, test, and we want to know, can we learn if they actually have coronary heart artery disease? In fact, if they have their arteries, the blood flow in their arteries is somehow being blocked by some blockage in the arteries, actually. So the problem, as I said, is that normally to assess that, at least with a lot of certainty, involves doing a catheterization. It's an angiogram, and which involves certainly an invasive procedure. So the data that I'm going to use, actually, or that I'm going to use to illustrate, is data that came from a radiology center. At this radiology, over the years, they collected data. I'm actually going to concentrate, for a reason that I'll explain later, on 5,000 patients, around 5,000 patients, that came to the clinic for this regular checkup. So the population, actually, that I'm interested in is a population of patients that they were asymptomatic. All these patients were asymptomatic, were sent to the clinic by their doctors. The data that we have is the data that the radiology center had, which essentially had some patient characteristics that the patients filled at the radiology center, and the result of the EVCT. And then these patients agree to actually be in follow-up. If they were sent to an to have an angiogram, then we were going to collect that data, or they were going to collect that data as well, and get information on disease verification. But in fact, only 379 of them were actually sent for an angiogram. And, okay, now EVCT actually gives you a score, a calcification score, which is a continuous variable. It's a variable that is measured in a continuous scale. Low scores mean basically you're healthy, you don't have calcification. High scores are calcified. So here is, and this is a bad picture because this picture should have been there. The one on there and the one on here are the verified patients. These are the unverified patients. These are histograms of the EBCT scores on the patients that we got. And these are the disease patients, only 28 out of the 370-something patients that were verified were actually found disease. The other 351 were not. And essentially, what we want to know is, does EBCT discriminate well between disease and non-disease patients? Essentially, we want to know, are these two curves really separated? Okay? Let me just mention a couple of things on these curves. Essentially, what you can see is that, of course, most of the non-verified patients were patients that have very low calcification levels. But in fact, there were a few, 13 patients out of all these verified patients, that had calcification level equal to zero. So they, even though they had risk factors, but they, even though they had calcification zero, they were still sent by their doctors for verification. So they might have had some reason for that other than just the the EBCT score. All right, now, EBCT has been claimed in the past not to be a good screening test because it has low specificity. In other words, the rate of false positive, it's been claimed, is very high. Now, and what that means is that if you see here, the percentage of non-disease patients, if you look at this histogram, in which the EBCT score is high, it's relatively high. So the question is it high because we are forgetting all these other patients that if we would have verified them, we would have found them to be right there. So the big question is, where do we locate these patients? Because most likely what's happening is that these patients here should go in there, and if they go in there, the specificity, of course, of EBCT all of a sudden becomes much better. But of course, based on just this data set, what we have to do is make assumptions to be able to move this patient from here to one of these two places. We have to place the markers, the value of these scores, somewhere. In other words, we have to impute their disease values if we want to make any inference. Any imputation will involve some assumptions. So the question is, how do we place the assumptions? All right. Now, this is basically just to tell you what parameter I'm going to be looking at, but again, this is just an illustration. So the EBCT here is the score, that's Y. X is the binary indicator of disease. The sensitivity as at a particular threshold is just the probability that someone is classified as disease, as given that is disease. The specificity is the probability that someone is not classified, is classified as healthy, given that is healthy. And the ROC curve is the curve of sensitivity versus 1 minus specificity. It's true positive versus false positive. This is more or less the curves that we would get. Good curves are curves that are close to that 1-1 corner. And the area under the curve is one possibility for summarizing the discriminatory ability of the test. And if one does the calculation, the area under the curve, if one actually defines the curve, if the data were discrete by interpolating lines, in fact, the area under the curve is nothing but the probability that given a disease person, here X1 and X2 are two randomly chosen, X1, Y1, and X2, Y2 are just two pairs of random variables chosen from the population. And this is nothing. If you look just at the first one, the second one is irrelevant for our talk because Y is a continuous variable. But it's just the probability that Y2 is greater than Y1 given X2 equal 1, X1 equal 0. What does it mean? If I just look at a diseased person and a non-diseased person, what is the probability that, in fact, the score for the diseased person is higher than the score for the non-diseased person? And that's just what the area under the curve is measuring. Again, this other one I wrote because I wanted to be completely general in my development, and I wanted to do it also for discrete variables, but in our case, it seems y continues, the second term is zero. All right, now this is nothing but a functional of the distribution of y given x. That's all it is. I mean, it's what we are interested here is in one particular functional. I mean, it's a functional that involves double integrals, but it's just one functional. So, in fact, we can rewrite this functional, and we will for convenience, for what I will say later, we can write it down as just the ratio of two expectations. The first one is x1 times 1 minus x2 times this I12, which is nothing but a variable that we always observe, because it's a variable, it's a pair, that involves measurements of markers on two randomly selected individuals. Okay, so again, x1 and x2, and x1, y1, and x2 and y2 are IIDs. Okay, the pairs are IIDs, are randomly chosen from the population. So, the question then is, we want to estimate, the problem is, we want to estimate this particular functional using, when we don't look, when we don't see x1, xx in the entire population, when x is missing. Okay, now, if we didn't have missing disease indicators, if x was observing everyone, what we would do is we would just do the non-parametric maximum likelihood. All we would do is just replace E by EN, essentially evaluate under the empirical distribution of the data, and that will be fine. And what I want to show you, with the whole purpose of this talk, is actually to show you that we can replace this axis, impute this axis in a manner that is doubly robust, that is actually robust to two different models, a model for selection and a model for disease. And but in doing that, I have to first of all tell you the assumptions that I need to identify even this parameter when I have missing data. So again, essentially what I have to do is the following. Imagine I am in this group, and let's say that y was discrete. Okay, if y was discrete, one assumption, one possible assumption would be to say, well, within levels of y, at this level of y, the probability of x is the same in the verified sample as in the non-verified sample. So if I had, I don't know, 2% of the verified sample where this is, I would take 2% of these folks, move them here, and the other move them there. That's all I would do. Okay? Well, there's no reason, as I said, to believe that, in fact, people that were sent to verification, even though they had low levels of the marker, are like the people that were not sent to verification. So what can I do? Well, I can instead relate the distribution of the verified to the distribution of the non-verified, the probability of disease in the non-verified to the probability of disease in the verified via an exponential tilt, the same as Dan was doing. And to do that, before I do that, I want to say, well, I may have more variables. I may have, as I do in actually in this study, I have all these other variables that were collected on the patients when they came to the clinic, these V variables. We are using the same notation, actually, except for the missing data indicator. And I have R, the selection indicator. So what I really have is observed IID copies of R, Y, V, and a variable that is X when R is equal to 1, and oops, this should be not nil. This should be nil, empty, okay? There's nothing when R is equal to 0. We have coarsened data. So one possibility for identification is to say, okay, as I said, the AUC is not identified. It's identified, but we need untestable assumptions. And like Dan, one assumption that I can make is to identify them via an exponential tilt. Essentially, again, think about this tilt here not existing. If the tilt doesn't exist, all I'm saying is that within levels of the marker and possibly all other covariates that I measure, the distribution, the probability of disease is the same in the two groups. But if I actually believe that that's not the case, I have to make an assumption, the same as the assumption of missing at random. I have to make an assumption, and I can make it via the exponential tilt. Note that the tilt is such that In fact, I'm allowing that the tilt depends on Y and V. And that's reasonable, again, because possibly those that were not sent to verification, even though they have low levels of the marker, are not the same as those that were not sent to verification having high levels of the marker. Okay? They are making the assumption to depend, actually, on Y and V, the tilt. Question? No? Okay. All right. Now, there's something I want to say here, which is important in this verification status. There's implicit assumptions in this that are not necessarily always true. One assumption says that within levels, this assumption really says that within levels of Y and V, I do have people that were verified. Because if I don't have any people that were verified, of course I can't compare the non-verified with the verified. So say that if I had a situation where if someone had a low level of the marker and they were young and they were healthy and whatever, they would never be sent to verification, I would miss them. I'm not making any assumption here about them. Okay? So implicit in this, there is a big assumption about having a positive probability of being sent to verification within levels of Y and V. And I'll talk about how we can extend that at the end of the talk. Now, straight Bayes' rule says that this assumption is equivalent to the assumption that the logarithm, the logit of the probability of not being sent to verification is some function, a known function of Y and V plus Q of YV times X. Okay, so what we have really is a logistic regression model for verification given Y, X, and V, where we are actually assuming the dependence of selection on the disease, the unknown, the missing variable. Okay? All right. Now, as Dan said, and I'm going to be very fast here, the function Q is not verified, and that should be, it's not identified. That should be obvious, right? Because it's telling me, it's comparing the two distributions, the distribution in the verified versus the distribution in the non-verified. There's nothing in the data that can tell me about that distribution. The AIC is identified once the function Q is specified. The function H actually is identified. That appears in the logistic regression for selection is identified. And specifying the function Q does not impose restrictions over the observed data distribution. Again, think about what I'm doing. I'm actually not saying anything about the verified, okay? And I'm not saying anything about the distribution of the markers in the unverified ones. And the distribution of what I do see in the unverified. So, what can I do? I can do a sensitivity analysis, the same as Dan was doing. I repeat the analysis over a range of possible functions Q. And how do I do that? I need to get an estimator. I need to get an estimator of the AUC. So this is the part where Dan went fast. I'll try to go a little bit slower because actually in this part I'm actually going to, well, it's not that he went fast. He was not having covariates, and I have covariates. That's the basic difference. So, again, we have the area under the ROC curve, and calculation shows that, in fact, as a function for the observed data, as a function of the distribution of the observed data, I can write it down in this way. So look at what I have in there. I have R over pi being the probability of being selected, okay, R over pi times X, and 1 minus R over pi times X as well for the other subject, etc. So what am I doing? I'm actually weighting each person that was verified. I'm giving a weight, and that weight is actually creating a pseudo-population, and in that pseudo-population, under my selection assumption, the ratio of these two expectations is equal to the area that I want to estimate. But actually, this functional can also be expressed in another manner, this manner in which I actually replace the x's, the unknown x's, by their conditional expectation given their disease verification status Y and V. Okay? The point here is that I'm contrary to what's been done in most talks, where I'm assuming they were assuming missing at random, here I'm not assuming missing at random, but I have a model to link the verify to the non-verify. Okay? The problem here is that I have Y and V, and typically, well, Y is a continuous marker, and typically the type of covariates that I will have are also continuous, for example, age. And once I have that, I have a problem because I can't estimate these two without running into the curse of dimensionality. Okay, so I'm forced to put models. Okay? So, the question is, here I'm just repeating for you to understand, P, as I said, P actually, for me to calculate P, let me just go back here for a minute. For me to calculate estimators of these quantities, I will have to estimate the P's, correct? I will have to come up with estimators of these quantities. All right, now, to come up with estimators of these quantities, as I write here, actually involves coming up with estimators of these quantities only. Because I can write down, under my exponential tilt model, the expected value of X, given verification status Y and V, is actually a function of the expected value of X in the verified, given Y and V, times something that involves whether the verification status and the tilt, and some normalizing constant that is in here, that is actually, again, a function of the conditional expectation in the verified. So essentially, if I want to calculate P, I need to know this quantity here, because again, Q is given to me. Okay, so what I need to estimate is the conditional expectation of X in the verified, given Y and V. It's no different, actually, than missing at random, except that I'm tilting it, okay? Now, if I want to use, there is something in Spanish there, forget it. Okay, if I want to use the other one, I still have, again, I need to estimate the H function, which again is a functional of the observed data. Here is the functional exactly that it involves. And again, what it boils down to is actually estimating that function H. I need to estimate that function H. All right, now, once again, the same slide. And again, the point that I'm trying to make in repeating over and over this slide is that there are two ways in expressing this functional. Each one involves some unknown function of Y and V that I need to estimate, either the selection parameter, the H of Y and V, or the conditional expectation of X in the verified given Y and V. Now, if Y and V are discrete, then it's fine. And as I said, if Y and V are continuous, it's the curse of dimensionality. I won't repeat myself. But I'm forced then to put models. And I'm going now to go the brute way, even though everything that I will say about double robustness later on doesn't necessarily involve parametric models. It can be done with projection pursuit or any other type of lower dimensional models. So the first one is the disease model. I am going to impose some model for disease, and or I model the selection probabilities by imposing some low-dimensional model in the H part, in the dependence on Y and V. What did I want to say here? Right, I mean, I'm not saying anything here, let me remind myself. Nothing, right. I mean, to estimate mu, I mean, again, if I want to do this, again, remember, all I need to do is to, if I wanted to do the estimation, I have to replace P by its estimate. But to estimate P, as I said before, what I need is an estimator of the conditional expectation of X given this quantity, okay? So notice that what I'm actually doing when I force this model is just imposing a semi-parametric model on the distribution of the observed data, because I never actually specify the distribution of Y and B, for example, or the distribution of R given Y and B. I'm only specifying the distribution of X given R equal 1, Y and V. So if I wanted to do estimation of mu of that parameter under the model, all I have to do is maximize the semi-parametric likelihood. But this is an easy one because the high dimensional, the infinite dimensional nuisance parameter factors out of the likelihood, and what I'm left is with the standard logistic regression likelihood. Okay, so I do just straight logistic regression, and when I do that, and I replace my estimators by the MLE estimators, what I get is the semi-parametric maximum likelihood estimator of the quantity that I care about under the disease specification model with non-ignorability. All right, now, the point here is that I am imputing, like everybody else was saying, under a model. The model is the model for the exponential field plus the model for the disease under verification. And my imputation depends on the disease model being correct. If the imputation is wrong, I'm wrong. Again, if I want to do imputation under the selection model, what I have to do now is to impute, but to impute essentially by imputing zero for the non-verified and reweighting the verified. Okay? So how do I reweight? I have to reweight it exactly by the inverse probability. But how do I estimate gamma? Well, trivially, gamma would be estimated by logistic regression on A, Y, and V if Q was zero. But if Q is not zero, we don't have, actually, the possibility of doing logistic regression of R on Y, X, and V because X is missing. Okay? Let me remind you. Well, let's see. Where are we? Oh, no, no. Sorry. I went all the way down. Let's see. Here. I need to estimate gamma here, but I actually cannot run logistic regression to estimate gamma, because to estimate gamma, I will need to know X if I do logistic regression when X is not observed. So I cannot just solve this, estimate gamma by logistic regression. But I can actually use unbiased estimating equations for gamma. In fact, I can use unbiased estimating equations based on actually the restriction that defines gamma. In fact, gamma, or in fact the HYV function, is defined by the fact that the conditional expectation of R over pi, given Y and V, is equal to 1. So, in fact, if I take R over pi minus 1 and multiply by any function of Y and V, that should give me an unbiased estimating equation for gamma. So that's what I do, and in fact, I solve that, and now I plug in the gamma, and I get an unbiased estimating, an unbiased estimator for nu, for the area under the curve. But, in fact, that estimator is not necessarily efficient. And if I want to improve my efficiency, and for reasons that are unrelated to efficiency but that relate to what I will say in a minute, I can actually enlarge the pool of estimators by actually adding to this inverse-weighted probability estimate imputed value, I can add something here that actually, when gamma is the true gamma, has mean zero. In fact, I add here an R over pi minus 1 times some function of Y and V. Again, this thing here, when gamma is at the true value, has mean zero. So I'm adding something. The effect of adding that is to improve efficiency, again. Note that, just to help you think about it, suppose that gamma was known. So I would write here gamma star rather than gamma. Well, if I were just to use this, it would be terribly inefficient because I will only be using data from the verified subjects. I will never be using data from the non-verified subjects. This extension here, this augmentation, allows me to use data from the non-verified subjects even when gamma is known. All right. Now, once I do that, and I let myself run all the U's and all the A's, what I actually obtain is a class of estimators of nu that actually is comprised by all estimators of the area under the curve that are actually regular asymptotically linear, up to asymptotic equivalence. The reason I know that is because, in fact, Jamie and I have a paper that nobody cites. They all cite the 94 paper. Nobody cites the 97 paper, where we did all this extension of missing at random to non-ignorable, and we derived the influence functions for estimators that under models that regular estimators under models that are parametric for the selection model under non-ignorability. Well, we have a parametric model now under non-ignorability. So I know how to derive all the influence functions, and when I look at the influence functions of these estimators, they happen to be, you know, all the influence functions, so I know I have them all. So then I also know that there is one which is optimal, one choice of u. That remember, the u is the function that I use to estimate gamma. And one choice of a, it's the one a that I add to the augmentation term, and both together give me the semi-parametric efficient estimator. Now, I actually don't think efficiency is a big issue in this problem, because we are going to do sensitivity analysis, and in fact the uncertainty you do model selection or model uncertainty is much higher probably than the uncertainty due to sampling variability. So in fact, it's not so much that I'm telling you this because of the results, technical results, but actually because there's one particular estimator in this class, one particular choice for the function A, which happens to give me magically, and not so magically, I'll explain you in a minute, an estimator that it's actually going to be consistent and asymptotically normal so long as either the selection model is right or the disease model is right. Okay? As I said before I had a model where if the selection model was right, an estimator, the ML estimator, where if the selection model was right, it was going to be consistent and asymptotically normal. Then I had the inverse probability augmented estimators that were going to be consistent and asymptotically normal if the selection model was right. Well, there is one choice for that inverse probability estimator which actually gives me double robustness. Double robustness in the sense of consistency under both models, consistency and asymptotic normality under both models. And that choice actually corresponds, surprise, to the choice where I choose the function A to be the conditional minus the conditional expectation of X in the unverified. What the disease model would tell me would be what I would have to impute for subjects if they were not verified. That function over there actually gives me double robustness. The reason is because not the deep reason, but if one does the calculation and one wants to convince that this estimator is double robust, oops, the way to convince yourself rather than the deep way is by just doing a calculation and showing that actually this imputed value, this XD gamma mu, satisfies this. It's the expected value of X given R, Y, and V, plus some noise U, where that noise U has mean zero, even if I misspecify the gamma, even if I misspecify the selection model. So let me just try to explain you because, okay, well, this is just algebra, but essentially, if you look at this, the first part certainly is going to give me an imputed value that is fine if the disease model is right. Correct? I'm imputing the expected value of X given R, Y, and Z under the disease model. The question is U going to have mean zero even if gamma is wrong, even if I use the wrong selection model? And the answer is yes. And the answer is yes because U can be written, U is R times this times X minus its conditional expectation among the disease, the verified, sorry, and some function of Y and V that has the gamma in it, but it's a function of Y and V, times R times the tilde. So it's R times the tilde times X minus the conditional expectation given R equals zero. So in here, I'm actually tilting the distribution of X by the right tilde. So this part here, it has mean zero if mu is correct, if the disease model is correct, no matter what I put in here. Now, the reason then why this estimator is doubly robust is because the conditional expectation, this is not right. The conditional expectation of VR given Y and V is the same as the conditional expectation of X given Y and V. Okay, this is not, the slide is wrong, obviously, because I'm having a function of Y and V. So again, the conditional expectation of X VR given Y and V is equal to the expected value of X of the thing that I'm trying to impute given Y and V if gamma is equal to gamma star and the selection model is correct, or if mu is equal to mu star and the disease model is correct. Now, using U processes theory, because what I have is a U statistic, I can actually derive the influence function for the estimators, either the ML or the augmented estimators or the W robust. And from these, I can derive consistent variance estimators. And I actually can, we can also derive goodness of fit tests of both the selection and disease models by essentially what we have is, if I have the W robust estimator and if my disease model is correct, both the W robust and the disease model should be converging to the same place. So in fact, I have a mean for testing, for doing goodness of fit tests. And I can actually calculate the variance of the difference of these two because I have the influence functions of both estimators, and I can actually calculate the joint influence function. So now, let me just say briefly one line about why these things are actually W robust. They did not come out of nowhere. We did not figure them out just by chance. In fact, there is a deep reason, and the reason is, in this problem, what I have is an estimator that I want it to be consistent or regular asymptotically linear if the selection model is right or if the disease model is right. So if I look at the situation where I know the selection model, I have to have an estimator that is going to be consistent and asymptotically normal in the model where the disease model is completely unspecified. So it has to be, the estimator that I have to have an influence function that is going to be an influence function in the model where the disease model is fixed and known and the selection and the, well, the selection model is fixed and known and the disease model completely unknown. Vice versa, it has to be an influence function in a model where the selection model is fixed and the disease model is unknown. So, in fact, because the scores for the selection model and for the disease model actually span the space of all scores in the non-parametric model, in the model where both the disease and the selection model are completely unspecified, what I'm left is that if there is one estimator that is going to be W robust, it will have to be, it will have to have actually the influence function equal to the influence function in the model where both models are unspecified. So when I look at the form of the influence function of the estimator in that particular model, there is only one because the model is non-parametric, and in non-parametric models there are only one, there's only one influence function for every RAL estimator, I'm left with the situation where, oh well, I know exactly what B function I have to add. I know that there are no many functions B. In other words, when I said here, every time I add a B, I get an estimator that is consistent and asymptotically normal. One of them has to be consistent and asymptotically normal in the non-parametric model, where I also don't know the disease model. And the one that I look for is the one that has that A function, that specific A function. And that's how I actually find the W robust estimator. Now, if the W robust estimator equals to the most efficient estimator in the model where the selection model is known. In other words, I have an inverse weighted probability augmented estimator. Well, I have an inverse probability weighted augmented estimator that is optimal if the selection model is known. Okay? And my question is that estimator the same as the W robust estimator? Do they have the same asymptotic distribution? Are they asymptotically equivalent? And the answer is only if I have assumed that Q is zero. Because when Q is zero, I know that in the model where I don't specify the selection probabilities, I have to have the same influence function, the same efficient estimator as the model where I do specify the selection probabilities because I have missing at random and the likelihood factorizes. So there's It's the same, the efficient estimator will be the same whether I know the selection model or I don't know the selection model. So in that particular model, in the model where I have Q equal to zero, the inverse, the optimal, the efficient estimator, the efficient augmented estimator under missing at random coincides with the W robust estimator, or the influence functions are the same, but not otherwise. All right. How much? 5 more minutes? Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to just go straight to the example. So, as I said, I had 5130 subjects that had EBCT. 379 were verified. And what I'm going to use here for just illustration purposes is V is going to be 8 and aspirin use. Okay, these are the two covariates that we have on the subject. And I'm just going to use it for illustration purposes only because I actually think that Q of YV should depend on Y. I'm going to make it constant on the entire range. And, well, I'm going to just go straight to this. So here is the picture of the sensitivity analysis when I look at the various estimators. What you see here is the W robust estimator, that's the black line, and the dotted line is the weighted optimal. I told you the weighted optimal has the same influence function the weighted optimal and the W robust when Q is equal to zero. In this case, it's beta equal to zero. And actually, for the W robust, I'm actually using when I estimate the gamma, I use the optimal estimating equation for the gamma. Had I known, had I used the model for disease, the optimal estimating equation under the selection model. So the two coincide here. The two don't coincide, as I said before, away from that, but they are actually very close in this example. The unaugmented, the estimator that use B equal to zero, that only does R over pi, actually is underneath, and the augmented is above the W robust. Well, there is a reason for that, and the reason is in the models that I use, what happened is that the probability of disease was actually the probability of not being diseased given low levels of the markers. The fitted values for that, the predicted values, were actually were higher than what's shown in there. So in fact, what happened is that when I used the selection, the disease model, these guys, most of them, went to that arm rather than going to here. In contrast, when I used the selection model, what happened is that some of these folks here were not represented by the folks in that arm. They were actually represented by the folks in here. So the model was the imputation was pushed in the other direction, and there was a little bit less underestimation of the predicted ability. Anyway, well, okay, so let me say a few things about double robustness with non-ignorability. This whole thing is great, but unfortunately, it does not always work. Double robustness in problems where we have point exposure, like here, where we have just one time, we find estimators that are double robust. I mean, we do the theory and we find the estimators. I told you we have a way to actually pinpoint in if there is a W robust estimator, which one should it be? But unfortunately, once we look at the necessary condition, not always is true that those candidates are W robust. In fact, when you do longitudinal data with non-ignorability, there's no hope for double robustness. There's no double robustness. There is, though, if there is missing at random, ignorability, because we know that the estimators that are projecting onto the space of the selection parameters are actually doubly robust. Well, I'll stop here.